Well, it's very nice to be here at one of my favorite institutions, the Massachusetts Historical Society. But in this book will take us far from Massachusetts, which I hope we won't mind, at least to journeying in sort of imagination and history, and actually takes us far from the usual time period I study, which normally is the years between the Revolution and the Civil War, and the region of New England. So it's been a real adventure for me in trying to understand the working lives of so many ordinary Americans, to see what kind of pattern that made, and to see what kind of overall sense I could make of that vast tapestry of experience. And what I'm going to do is show you, generally, some images from the book. The book really is composite of both images and stories, individual stories that we try to connect as well with a kind of overall interpretive narrative. But in some ways, if you look at the book, the stories could tell the story themselves, the narratives too, but I think intertwined they tell a richer story. But I'll start with a question about history. What the hell does anybody need to know about history? Said a man named Ed Smith. He was a tough old fisherman living in New Bern, North Carolina, when he was interviewed for the WPA in 1939. He was sure.
Could you get a little, move the microphone a little
closer to me? If I can.
This is the microphone.
Oh. shows you, right? How was that, sir? Is that better?
We shall see.
Okay. or we shall hear. Tell me how that works. Better? So we can even try more. So let's start again then. What the hell does anyone need to know about history? Said Ed Smith. He was a tough old fisherman in New Bern, North Carolina, interviewed for the WPA in 1939, at the very end of my period of study. He was sure that history didn't account for the experience of ordinary people like him, and he suspected that it was just a lot of made-up mess about things that never happened. On the other hand, the historical narrative of his own life that he presented clearly made perfect sense, both to him and to us, as he described his hardscrabble days working as a fisherman and a boatman on the water, and then later, after he got some physical disabilities, as a house painter. In his own way, I think the book I wrote tries to answer Ed Smith's question. Despite the conviction of many working people, and I said I'd have to include my own father, that things, quote, never happen like the history books say, I think I have sought to do justice to their experiences. So Where We Worked is a book of pictures and stories about the work of ordinary Americans in our past. House and home may be our refuge, as many people have argued, and I even argued in my book Where We Lived about American houses and families. But for almost all of us, work is our destiny, and the workplace is our destination. Work, for better or for worse, shapes much of who we are, what we know, and how we live. And as the United States becomes a post-industrial society with an economy based on information and services, many kinds of work that once defined our lives are disappearing. Textile factories and steel mills have almost vanished from most parts of places on the American landscape. Farms, mines, and timberlands are worked by great machines rather than human muscle. Typewriters, once a symbol of efficiency in modern communication, are now relics. There'll be a museum of them fairly soon. This book explores a world of work, then, that has been rapidly receding from my memory and experience. It's built around the remarkable visual resources of the Library of Congress, which from the 1830s through the 1930s provided a great wealth of photographic and other pictorial documentation of American workers and their work and their workplaces. So the narratives of this book are intertwined with those images. Well, I'll tell you that story hangs a tale. We'll get to that in a minute. They are based on diaries and traveler's descriptions, reminiscences and autobiographies, eyewitness accounts and oral histories. They try to tell the stories over time of wheat growers and sharecroppers, mill girls and housemaids, gold miners and railway porters, farm wives and cowboys, newsboys and stenographers. Now, stories of two families in particular, my own and my wife's, are threaded into this narrative in places, not because they were extraordinary, but precisely the opposite reason, because they seem so representative. I've said that every reader of this book could provide similar ones from their own family history. I'm sure you could, and in a sense, what this book is an invitation for you to reflect on your own history of what your parents and grandparents and everyone else you know did for work, and add it to the archive of American experience. So I hope you will. For me, they provided a sense of personal connection to a vast story. So the overall narrative of this book begins in the 1830s, when in the midst of a vast tide of westward migration, the Industrial Revolution, and sweeping changes in transportation, just have to get this, commerce were underway. It ends in the 1930s, when the great economic engine that had been created over the previous 100 years seems to have broken down. Over the course of that 100 years, the United States became the world's greatest agricultural producer. Americans explored and exploited our country's vast resources of land, timber, and minerals, spanned the continent with railroads, and created an immense industrial base. The United States took in millions of immigrants and built great cities. In those years, Americans were, in the memorable words of Morton Keller of Brandeis University, one of my own favorite history teachers, quote, a brutally vigorous people, as he said. The nation's stunning economic growth was the result of almost incalculable effort, the work of many millions of hands, and often came at great cost. So what I focused on, the experience of ordinary workers and households and craft shops, farms and railroad lines, mines and forests, factories and offices. Now that's not to say that the work of story of other kinds of workers, perhaps we could call them elite workers, managers, professionals, officials, are not worth telling. It simply recognizes that most of those stories have already been told, often by themselves. Instead, this book tries to represent the unrepresented or the underrepresented. So why did I end in the 1930s? Well, one answer is in the materials, and the fact the strongest Library of Congress visual collections go up through those years. Another reason, of course, is the Library of Congress collections are free. And so when we try to put a highly visual book together with over 400 pictures, using pictures that were in the national treasury, in the public domain, as it were, was obviously a strategy that my publisher thought highly of. So the other is that World War II, at least seemed to me, provided a clearly defined breaking point, one of history's sudden transitions. A comparable account of Americans at work for the years from 1941, those years of my own life, as I was born in 1943, would need a very different book based on very different resources. And so I said to my editor when he first thought maybe we could take it up to 2000, I said, I'm sorry, that's not the story I know how to tell. Someone else is going to tell that story. So those years, though, are now in the fairly distant past, a world of three generations ago and more, although many of us remember bits and pieces of it. Does it still matter to look how Americans spent those countless years of labor? Well, I guess I think so. I would say only if we want to understand where we came from. That's why. And this image thereby hangs a tale. This is my family. That's my father on the left. That's my grandfather Morris. That's me. And that's my Uncle Bill. My Uncle Bill. Growing up on Chicago's south side with its endless miles of brick bungalows and three flat apartments, I could not have felt more disconnected from the land. The city was full of trees, and most houses had lawns, but no one gardened, let alone farmed, that I knew. The only four-legged animals around were dogs and cats, and the working men I knew were bus drivers and accountants, lawyers, and police patrolmen. But right outside the city, though far from view, stretched the fields and silos of Illinois, just about the richest farmland in America. But none of that had anything to do with me, or so I thought. But many years later, when I started to look back and learn about my family's history before Chicago, specifically about Morris Larkin, my father's father, I found myself one generation removed from life on a Midwestern farm, which I had not known. My father was the youngest, and he knew the least family history of all, so I had to reconstruct it all. I uncovered the shared story of many of our ancestors, of an immense migration from farm to city that swept America not all that long ago. I had almost assumed that my Irish great-grandparents had found themselves in Chicago after passing through one of the usual portals of arrival from Ireland, New York, Boston, or Philadelphia. I also assumed that they, like the great majority of Irish immigrants, had given up working the land on the old side to become city folk, finding jobs as laborers and servants in this country. But when I found Morris as a 12-year-old boy in the schedules of the 1870 census, I discovered that my grandfather wasn't living in a tenement in Chicago, as I had assumed. He was on a dairy farm with my great-grandparents in Lyons Township, Illinois, 30 miles from the city. One of my brothers now lives in Lyons Township, Illinois, and I told him to check the deed because maybe he was on my grandfather's land, his great-grandfather's land. So my great-grandparents, turned out, owned a $900 farm and sold chickens and cows and sold milk to the city. It was a bit surprising because most Irish immigrants didn't go into farming. But they did. They lived on a farm like that. The great majority of them had grown up on tiny plots of rented land, growing only potatoes for subsistence and selling a pig every year to pay the rent. When they arrived in the United States, most had little money and few agricultural skills, and very often associated farming with poverty, disaster, and starvation. John and Annie Larkin, however, fared better. They must have seen farming as a path to independence, as they found the money and skills they needed to work the Illinois prairie. So I began to reconstruct the kind of work that Morris would have done. Here's a man of about that time plowing the Illinois prairie with a horse-drawn plow. And so then my book moved on after I began that sort of family introduction to that, to looking at the faces of farming, New England ox drovers, a girl in Colorado milking, a farmer in Kansas standing proudly behind his $1,000 steam plow, while his wife and daughters in their immaculate white dresses stand behind him looking, and the wife all of a sudden thinking, you know, he won't buy a cook stove, but $1,000 plow is no problem. But what I'm hoping to do, and then began to look at such agricultural rituals, the history of getting in the hay, the movement west, plantations and slaves. There's so many stories in the book, I can't tell them all to you tonight. So I'm just going to look at some of the stories we looked at, and then I'm going to talk about some specific ones. And one that really interested me, because I didn't know much about it, was the question of farming on the Great Plains. So, the late 19th century story. Farming always had its risk. Weather, pests, and the cycles of the economy were generally beyond any farmer's control. But the risks on the Great Plains, as people began to settle them starting in the 50s and 60s and then in vast quantities after the Civil War, were magnified to match the scale of its vast and open landscape. The prairies of Illinois, oh, by the way, that's a cyanotype. That's actually printed with a process that actually involves cyanide, but that creates this amazing effect. Now look at that Nebraska prairie just going on forever. It's terrifying, beautiful and terrifying at the same time. The prairies of Illinois, the fields of Ohio, the rolling hills of Pennsylvania, or the granite walls of Massachusetts were tranquil gardens in comparison. Some found this endlessness and the abundance that went with it exhilarating. Others saw it as lonely, even terrifying. On every hand, wrote E.V. Smalley, a close observer of rural life in 1896, the treeless landscape stretches to the horizon. In summer, it is checkered with grain fields or carpeted with grass and flowers, but 1 mile of it is almost exactly like another. In the 1870s, as the tide of settlement continued in places in Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas, farm families found themselves moving into an environment more precarious than they could have imagined based on 200 years of experience farming elsewhere in America. They're running up against the permanent realities of the North American climate. The Great Plains are huge and windblown with hot summers and very cold winters. Challenging for farmers, but not impossible. Rainfall was the key. West of Iowa, Missouri, and Minnesota, average annual rainfall starts to decline rapidly. Responding to this, the trees thin out and disappear. Today, geographers mark what they call the line of semi-aridity, usually defined as the 98th meridian on the plains. It's an invisible line and an important one. East of the line, there's enough rain to grow farm crops. West of the line, there isn't. But usually is a tricky word. Even east of the line, a few years of drought could destroy crops. And west of the line, a few years of high rainfall could deceive everyone into thinking that they were safe, that they had found the veritable garden in the heart of America. None of this was well understood in the 19th century. Farmers knew that the climate got drier as they went west, but they were constantly assured by land promoters and railroad officials that whatever rain fell would always be enough to make the money. The earliest time of reckoning came in 1874. I think we'll go to this one, right. Farmers in Kansas were struggling with 2-month-long drought, but that was a minor nuisance compared with the hordes of grasshoppers. Rocky Mountain locusts that descended on Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas at the very end of July. It was a plague of Old Testament proportions, as Bible reading families ruefully noted, and as the Topeka Press tells us. We can eat, but oh, what's left, said the grasshoppers. Right. So, the sun was almost darkened, wrote the correspondent for the New York Times. The Times had a Topeka correspondent back then. With the myriads of grasshoppers coming in from the mountains, working rapidly eastward, taking corn, vegetables in their course, they have literally stripped the farms and gardens of the entire state. In many counties, he said, where the new settlers have staked everything on the chance of a bounty yield, all is lost. All is lost. Alternating cycles of despair and hope would prove to be the reality of farming in the Great Plains. Grasshoppers were bad enough, but the fluctuating climate was even worse. The years from the mid to the 70s to the 80s were unusually warm and wet. And the winters seemed no worse than Iowa and Illinois. These favorable conditions led to a flood of settlers. Let's see, we can go back. There they are. There they are in the sod hut. There's the sod hut, the family out proudly posed. Some advocates, in fact, developed a wonderfully self-serving theory about the climate, now long discredited. They claimed that settlement itself, by breaking the soil and creating cultivated fields, was going to change weather patterns for the better. It would make things warmer and help the rain to fall. The more farmers there were, the more successful farming would be. But these hopes were dashed during the late 19th century. So what we have is the story basically of alternating cycles of hope and despair in the middle of the country, which I think help us understand a lot about Granger and populist politics and the volatility of the farm vote in the 19th century. In 1896, Stephen Crane, the author of The Red Badge of Courage, was out in the Midwest describing the devastation. He said, "A prosperous country was brought to a condition of despair. As the drought went on, the hot wind raged like a pestilence. Farmers were helpless with no weapon against this terrible and inscrutable wrath of nature. They had become, quote, spectators at the strangling of their hopes, their ambitions, all they could look to from their labor." And Crane wrote eventually, "The country died." The country died. That's how it looked in 1896. But of course, it eventually returned to life. The climate cycle and the cycle of settlement continued to return. But it was one of the stories that struck me perhaps most profoundly. Well, one story you'll have to read the book to read about cowboys. Sorry. Or the Dust Bowl, which again is a continuation of the narrative about the dangers of farming on the Great Plains, or Pickers and Packers, the stories of the people who went to the labor camps to pick oranges and berries and peaches in the 1920s and 30s with the vast commercialization and expansion of that kind of agriculture. Extraordinary stories. I also wanted, though, to tell the stories of mechanics or craftsmen. American craftsmen didn't call themselves craftsmen. They called themselves mechanics. And here we can see them in a gallery. Let's see. A tailor with his enormous tailor's goose. 4 shoemakers. 2 blacksmiths working while a young boy watches, and a cooper standing next to his barrel. These wonderful, the first occupational photographs in American history. These daguerreotypes from the 1850s in the Library of Congress. But one of the things I wanted to tell was the story. Let's just see where that went. Aha. was a story of two crafts that caught my interest.
You're
in the.
Not going to use the microphone.
Yeah, It's the story of two crafts that caught my interest in the 19th century: the painters and the hatters. All crafts had their elements of danger, but these two crafts had an extraordinary. Turned out, dealt with extraordinary risk. Both essentially dealt with poisons in the everyday course of their work. Painters dealt with basically white lead, which was lead with lead sulfate. The only way to make paint that would last was to mix white lead pigment with linseed oil. It had to be done on the spot. And men who painted, and we can see some of their equipment right there. The men who painted essentially lived and breathed with had linseed oil all over themselves, but lived and breathed with lead sulfate day after day after day after day. Lead sulfate produces lead poisoning. The mortality among painters was actually shockingly high, and it was well known. It's well known. The business journals by the 1870s, by the time that industrial chemistry had been advanced enough to discuss this, knew this well, but essentially said, well, we've been looking for a solution, but we haven't found one yet. And after all, industry demands this. Painting needs to go on. Painters need to be more comfortable. Perhaps they shouldn't eat their lunches where they're working. Well, the painters said, where else can we eat our lunch? How can we get away from the materials of our trade? It really wasn't until the 1920s that conditions of painting were changed enough for the mortality rates to decline. And even more so striking is the question of hatters. A solution of mercury was necessary up to about 1890 or 1900 in order for the proper felting of animal fur to create a hat. And these hatters here are in fact working with something, and it's called reddening. So the reddening of this material had to be done with mercury. It was the only way, so it was said in the trade, to make a decent hat. Result was that something like 25 to 30% of all hatters wound up with the symptoms of mercury poisoning by the ends of their effective working lives. They were the streets of Danbury, which is the hat capital of the United States. People said you found men staggering around who you thought were drunk, but in fact they simply were hatters who had the symptoms of mercury poisoning: excess salivation, tremors, inability to control their limbs, ultimately resulting from many in brain damage and very often early death. And in fact, recent environmental studies done in the 1990s by a team of archaeologists and environmental scientists of the Danbury area have discovered that there's still extremely high concentrations of mercury in the community, in the river, and in the areas where the hat shops were, even though mercury use was discontinued somewhere between 1910 and 1915. So it's still there. It was a story of a difficult story in terms of trying to understand how Americans, thinking of all those men here shown at a Danbury hat factory, a kind of wonderful sculptural photograph, I think. But what do we think of the risks they were taking to make their living? Other kinds of work. We tell the story of how printing was transformed, of course, from a handcraft ultimately by the 1890s into essentially a form of noisy, banging, complex industrial production, as typesetting went from a handcraft to essentially a mechanical enterprise. Part of the interesting part of the story of this, as I discovered, was that as typesetting was removed from printing per se, and printing per se became steam-powered, women began to be engaged as typesetters. The problem was, from the point of view of the printers, that women were much better at typesetting than men. Women were faster. There were typesetting competitions by the 1880s in the printing guilds. Literally, it was a form of public entertainment. It's a little hard to imagine, but you can imagine five young printing journeymen standing up on a stage with 1,000 people watching, and they were each given a page type to set and type, and running to do that, and the winner would get a prize, and people actually went to watch. Well, what happened was, after a major competition in Chicago, someone else brought a couple of women up on stage, and they outdistanced the men pretty substantially. This did not make the typographic unions happy. And in fact, a lot of them were much happier when they finally went to the linotype machines, because linotype machines were obviously big, noisy, hot industrial machines that women had to be kept away from at all costs anyway. And so this kind of technological change actually wound up having this kind of this, perhaps one would say a perverse effect, but certainly a complicated effect. And of course, there's women's work, which was never done, and the book tells the story of that. And a domestic service, and I intertwine the story of several of my great aunts who came from Ireland and did domestic service for 30 or 40 years until they could finally get my grandfather over and send him to law school, which is the Murphy family narrative of that side of my family. Not an unfamiliar narrative, I know. And then I wanted to tell the story of seamstresses, and this is another story just to share with you a bit. Because it's a story about a kind of work that's often overlooked and not very much discussed historically. I got the idea when I was a small child, wrote Lucy Larcom in 1889 in her autobiography, A New England Girlhood, that, quote, the chief end of woman was to make clothing for mankind. Unfortunately, she hated to sew. Larcom's sisters, she said, were all remarkable needlewomen capable of, quote, exquisite lace embroidery, or expert at fine stitching, so delicately done that it was a pleasure to see and wear. But here we have perhaps the cartoon representation of Lucy and her mother, where this is a woodcut called the hated task, and you can see a very unhappy young girl. But it became clear, as Lucy said, that she would never, quote, conquer fate with my needle. She was tirelessly instructed by her mother and older sisters, but the results, quote, usually ended in defeat and mortification. Given the realities of 19th century domestic life, Lucy's mother and sisters were right to be concerned about her lack of talent with the needle. Needlework was thought to be an essential woman's skill and part of every girl's training at home. In 1840, of course, we know that the majority of American women hand-sewed the bulk of their family's clothes, as well as domestic textiles, from towels and sheets to bedspreads and window curtains. Lucy herself ultimately chose a single life as a teacher and writer, a life that perhaps incidentally, although we're not sure, required far less domestic needlework. She didn't have to sew very much. You get other people to sew for her. But here, we find this portrait. Cornelia Foster Smith, a physician's wife in Mount Vernon, New Hampshire, clearly felt that needlework was central to her identity when she had her portrait painted in 1842. Her husband chose to be depicted with his pill bottles and fearsome instruments of surgery. She decided to be painted with her elaborate sewing table. Its fringe cover conceals a hinged top that opened to store her work, all the pieces that she was making or mending. On top of the table is a piece of partially completed embroidery and a pincushion box with her needles and thimbles. Primadia is wearing a decorative lace cap, collar, shawl, and cuffs. The strong implication is all of which she had made herself. Lace work was difficult, intricate, and time-consuming, so it provides powerful testimony both to her skills and to the importance her society placed on women's self-adornment. But about 15 years after Primadia's had her portrait taken in 1842. Another young woman, whose name is unknown, sat in front of the then new daguerreotype camera to have her picture taken. Like Primelia, she looks out at us holding her sewing. The camera seems to have captured an emotion, drawing a piece of black fabric through her sewing machine. Her hair is severely parted and drawn back in two buns in the style of the mid-1850s. Her eyes seem a bit shadowed, although hand tinting has brought a little bit of life back to her complexion. Also like Primelia, she's fashionably dressed. But she is well-off housewife, however. Her right hand is highly visible, the third element that balances the picture between her compelling face and the machine. But her hand is not a delicate one. For a slight woman is large and muscular, the hand of a woman who has been sewing for a living for a long time. Because by the 1850s, sewing wasn't simply a female skill, a household necessity, and a badge of womanly accomplishment. It was becoming a vast industrial occupation. Household sewing remained an important part of many women's domestic work, but as the United States became a more urban and industrial nation, an increasing proportion of clothing, household linens, and even decorative pieces were being made outside the home. The manufacture of domestic garments for domestic wear is a never-ending task, wrote a Boston magazine. The brain is bewildered in attempting to estimate the many millions of stitches to be made daily in this United States. Making those millions of stitches were many thousands of women, an expanding population who found employment in what came to be called the needle trades, trying to turn their domestic skills, traditionally domestic skills, to account in the commercial economy. And here we have a picture of several hundred of them. An expanding market for ready-made textile goods of all kinds provided them with employment, but often on very harsh terms. The needle is the natural weapon of every woman who has to battle for herself in the world, wrote William H. Riding in Harper's Magazine in 1880. But, quote, the occupations in which it is available are so overcrowded and underpaid. The most skillful and fortunate needlewomen, a small minority, were able to set up their own businesses as dressmakers or milliners, and even took on their own apprentices. Still, even at this highest level of skill, they made less money than men, about one-third of the rate for male tailors, for doing very similar kinds of work. And the great majority of seamstresses, like these, were women struggling to survive, working long hours for meager earnings. They were usually single women without families to rely on, or married women whose husbands' wages could not support their household. They faced a buyer's market for their labor. Their numbers were large, and their skills were commonplace. Some toiled at home, relying on middlemen who handed out materials and collected a finished product. Others, like this, went out every day to their workplaces, crowded spaces and tenements building huge factory-scale workrooms, like the hundreds of young women who can be seen in this drawing of the vast fifth-floor hand sewing room of A.T. Stewart's department store in Lower Manhattan in 1875. This immense establishment, said the New York Times in 1872, is, quote, daily thronged by the wealth, beauty, and fashion of New York, who shop there. But in its workrooms labored over 700 girls. They sew, baste by hand and machine, embroider, work buttonholes, and make carpets, curtains, all kinds of household items. For the prosperous families that shopped at Stewart's, girls were providing the shirts and dresses, cloaks and lingeries, towels, tablecloths, and curtain the respectable family life required. But the writer for the Times stressed to discover the meager earnings of the seamstresses in return, to quote, the scanty remuneration paid to hardworking, industrious women who earn a miserable living by the needle. He saw as well that the work rules required no discussion of any sort about no discussion of rates of pay, no brief intervals of time away from the sewing tables. Conspicuously posted in the workroom was this sign. All who are dissatisfied with the prices paid for work will please leave immediately. Any persons found loitering in the room or passages will be instantly dismissed. How are we doing on time?
Let's see. We've got it's about 7:15, so maybe, about
15,
20 more minutes.
Okay, fine.
And then we'll take some time for questions.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Okay. So we see that the sewing machine then sewing then becomes increasingly mechanized until we wind up with the Arrow Shirt Factory in 1910, and you can see probably there are probably something like 2,000 women employed stitching shirts on the sewing machine. A new kind of work, which essentially winds up being essentially the mechanization and incessant repetition of work for women. Well, then we go on, the book goes on to talk about loggers, very different work, the textiles, mining, to tell the story of the great anthracite strike of 1902, which is worth telling, I think, from the point of view of another kind of work issue, which is the question of discord in the labor market. Let's just get to that. There we go. There we go. Oops. Excuse me. It's a small technical glitch. Here we go. Sorry about that. Okay. Now, at the turn of the 20th century, 150,000 men work at the anthracite mines producing coal, producing 60 million tons of coal a year. But there was trouble. Anthracite is that hard coal, right, as opposed to the soft bituminous coal. Anthracite is hard coal. Anthracite was a uniquely critical commodity in the American economy at the time. Much cleaner to handle and burn than bituminous coal, it was used by millions of American families to heat their homes. It was the household fuel for virtually all the cities throughout the heavily populated Northeast and Great Lakes. So from New York to Chicago, Minneapolis and St. Paul, virtually every home in all those cities was heated with anthracite. But anthracite was found only in one place, in the coal fields of northeastern Pennsylvania. Any major disruption of production in that one region threatened much of the nation with a very cold winter. Unrest had always stalked the mines, of course, as opposed to the relatively mild labor unrest that involved the needle trades. Mining was a hard business, subject to cycles in the economy, overproduction. Miners wanted to be paid as much as possible for their difficult and dangerous work. Foremen and managers wanted to control their workers and meet their quotas for production. Mine operators wanted the lowest possible costs and the highest possible profits, of course. And as coal production expanded from the 1870s on in America, mine owners had increasingly recruited immigrant workers from Eastern Europe and Italy. Coal mines became polyglot workplaces, with more than a dozen nationalities represented and as many languages spoken. Let's see if we can go back to a picture of... There are six coal miners coming out of the pit in Scranton, Pennsylvania, probably speaking four different languages at the time. Right. Labor advocates charge, and most historians have since agreed, that this was done deliberately to keep the workforce divided, difficult to organize, and willing to accept low wages because they were divided by ethnic and religious antagonisms. Coal mine operators maintained it was simply good economics. But despite the barriers of language and culture, this new union, the United Mine Workers, was able to organize thousands of anthracite miners in 1900. Immigrant miners joined the unions in surprisingly large numbers. But owners refused to recognize the union, and their conflict resurfaced in 1902. Emboldened by their previous success, these miners pressed for another pay increase and a shortening of the 10-hour workday. And here's President Mitchell being accompanied by boys and miners as he comes for an organizing meeting. Operators argued, though, that union activity was destroying work discipline in the mines and the profits were too low to justify increases. And most owners bitterly resented the fact that they had been forced to concede in 1900 and resolved to break the union's power this time around. But then the strike began in 1912. I mean, the strike began on May 12th. There we go. And here we have a picture of the miners and the miners' families organizing to cheer them on May 12th. With the miners increasingly militant, the owners are willing to compromise. There was violence on both sides, ranging from fistfights to pitched battles. The companies expanded and armed their private police forces and recruited strikebreakers. Striking miners attacked the scabs and took the spots in the mines and often shunned and humiliated the families. The governor of Pennsylvania, who was more sympathetic to the owners of the miners, called out the National Guard, dispatched them to the coal mines to, quote, protect private property. But as the strike went on into the fall, fear mounted at the prospect, and it seemed a very serious prospect in 1902, at the prospect of an American nation without heat. President Theodore Roosevelt, in fact, foresaw misery with the certainty of riots which might develop into social war. Historically, American presidents had intervened on strikes on the side of property, often to crush unlawful union activity in the name of public order. But sensing a disaster in the making, and frustrated himself at the owner's recalcitrance, Roosevelt tried to mediate the strike. He was so determined to prevent a freezing winter and social discontent that he was prepared to seize control of the mines from both owners and miners and operate them with the manpower of the United States Army. Now, this is an interesting problem because, of course, none of the soldiers had ever worked in an anthracite mine, and it was a difficult and dangerous task, but Roosevelt was willing to threaten it. After months of frustration, tortuous negotiation, rising public anger, and great fear, people were literally terrified that they would freeze in the winter. And finally, the intervention not only of Roosevelt himself, but of J.P. Morgan, the banker. Some people said he was the most powerful man in the United States. Roosevelt arranged an end to the strike and the appointment of a commission of eminent men to arbitrate between the sides. After 163 days, the strike ended on October 22nd, barely in time for the first shipments to reach the cities for heating season. And so here we have Puck, which is the American humor magazine, on the lines of Punch, showing in 1902, showing the sword of Damocles hanging over the American nation. This was a strike that involved. Right. Our book also talks about the other kind of mining, the hard rock mining. We can see the gold and silver mining, the harvesting of the sea. It's a curious trade called oyster tonguing in Chesapeake Bay, whaling, fishing in the Atlantic. The earliest attempts to take black gold out of the oil field, the work of oil workers. Two stories about my father and my father-in-law, both of whom grew up in the Depression, developed mechanical skills and took rather different paths of work. My father-in-law, who was there at the age of 18, going on to become manager and vice president, going steadily up the factory floor. My own father never finding a kind of work that he ever cared for. Two different stories of young men in the Depression, coming into their own worlds of work, their own unique worlds of personal experience. The story of making steel, and perhaps the story, of course, that we all know in New England so well, the story of the textile mills, story of the railroads. And maybe the story I'll end with, although it's a hard story, it's in a way a hard story to tell, but it's the story I became interested in, is the story which I call a wonder and a horror, the story of the stockyards. For visitors to Chicago all across the long century that followed the Civil War, there was one sensation they would never forget. It was the stench of the world's largest stockyards, an olfactory wall that you encountered for the first time like a blow on the head. I remember this from my own younger days. "It hit me squarely between the eyes," wrote Englishman Nicholas Everett in 1915. "It penetrated through handkerchiefs, gloves, or deodorizer. There was no escaping it." The stockyards were an immense concentration of cattle, hog, and sheep pens. And here we see a bird's eye view. The slaughterhouses themselves are there, and here are just a few of the pens, right? Well, the sheep pens, holding an average of 30,000 animals a day, surrounded by dozens of enormous slaughterhouses and processing factories. The smell they created, said Everett, was, quote, strong, pungent, rancid, rancid, unforgettable. It was a smell of manure, blood, meat, and money. Perhaps especially money. In early America, the great bulk of butchering had been done on a small scale by individual farmers. As cities grew in the 19th century, urban livestock houses and slaughterhouses expanded to fit a larger population of families who did not slaughter to preserve their own meat, which, of course, was the farming tradition. By 1840, there were large markets outside major cities where farmers brought their animals to sell to dealers and butchers. Boston had its own, and Brighton, Cincinnati, was called Porkopolis because of its hog butchering business. But the 1870s and 1880s, after the Civil War, saw far greater change. With the advent of safe canning for meat, as well as vegetables and fruit, workable large-scale refrigeration, and increasingly rapid rail transportation. These innovations created a continent-wide market for meat and meat products, a flow of production and consumption that began with Western cattle. As I say in the book, we have to realize that the story of the cowboy is actually a story about city families wanting meat. Without the city families that wanted meat, the cowboys wouldn't even be a pleasant cultural myth. They wouldn't have existed. They wouldn't have existed at all. Right? A flow of production and consumption that began with Western cattle and Midwestern hogs and ended on the dining tables of millions of city and small town families. At the midpoint of the flow, and in control of it, were the great meat packers of Chicago and the Union Stockyards. There were other meatpacking cities like Omaha and Kansas City, but Chicago, where most of the nation's mail rail lines intersected, was dominant. By 1900, it was producing 4/5 of the meat produced in the United States. The stockyards and the packing houses, and here we see standing on top of the railings four men, buyers, brokers, and graders, judging and pricing the animals. They were both a wonder and a horror. Some observers were completely undisturbed, like a man named William Glazer in 1886, who simply noted the many miles of road or railroad track within the yard's expanse, the elegant exchange office, the banks and hotels for the cattlemen. Most had more complicated reaction. The stockyards were, quote, one of the most interesting sights in the United States, an early geographical reader told its young readers in 1998. The cattle which we see this morning, it said, will a few days later be on the breakfast tables of the people of New York, Washington, and other cities and towns. The yards, it said, were a city of animals within a city of men, and their stories went a vast scale and amazing technological progress. But it offered only uneasy praise. The men who ruled the yards, it added, were, quote, the most bloodthirsty rulers any city ever knew. They filled with the yards with new animals day by day, only to kill them. Novelist and reformer Upton Sinclair was the meatpacking industry's most devastating critic, recounting and publicizing its abuses. Yet he, too, was awed by the scale of the yards. He wrote in his famous novel, The Jungle, of 1906, of the vast extent of the cattle pens. North and south, as far as the eye can reach, he said, there stretches a sea of pens. And they were all filled, so many cattle no one had ever dreamed existed in the world. The sound of them was of all the barnyards of the universe, and as for counting them, it would have taken all day simply to count the pens. There was something about the enormous scale of the yards and the plants, their impressive efficiency, and their unrelenting mechanized violence that both attracted and repelled Americans and foreign visitors. By the 1890s, despite the stench, the stockyards had actually become a tourist attraction. Both the Swift and Armour companies, the two largest packers, established reception centers for visitors and offered guided tours. As a museum professional, I can well remember. They had little scale models and orientation places where you'd be told how to take the tour and staff members would lead you around. Right. At the time of Chicago's Great World's Columbian Exposition of 1893, the stockyards proved more popular than most of the exposition's more elegant exhibits. People flocked to them. But in the early 1900s, Armour was counting more than 100,000 visitors a year just to see the yards go on. Surrounding the stockyards and the packing plants was Packing Town, or Back of the Yards. Well, actually, my father was born. A sprawling community of workers and their families who had grown as rapidly as the industry themselves. Irish and German workers had settled there first, followed by Eastern European immigrants. Czechs, Slovaks, Poles, Croatians, Lithuanians, and Ukrainians. The neighborhood was intricately divided, like the mines, by language and ethnicity. Taken together, the plants clustered around the stockyards at the turn of the century constituted the single largest industrial center in the world. Within a single square mile worked 35,000 men and women toiling for five major packing companies, 250 miles of railroad tracks, between 8 and 10 million cattle, hogs, and sheep moved through the stockyards every year. But unlike steelmaking, which we did talk about, butchering is not a highly complex process. Animals are killed, and here we have, fortunately, both Armour and Swift like documenting the process, so I had lots of fairly unpleasant pictures to choose from. But animals are killed, drained of blood, and cut apart. Then the parts, as the school geography said, are turned into food and other things for the use of man. In other times, butchering has been a wasteful process as well, discarding over half the weight of animal carcasses. But the great Chicago meat packers searched a way to eliminate the waste, turning their slaughterhouses into ruthlessly efficient factories. The production cycle, from the arrival of animals at the stockyard through slaughter, processing, packaging, shipment, took no more than 48 hours. The key to this efficiency was the disassembly line, the mirror image of and inspiration for Henry Ford's later innovation, automobile production. As animals arrived at the packing house, they were hoisted on overhead rail lines, which took them through dozens of specialized workstations. They were stunned. Here's the man whose simply job was to kill animals in the head with a mallet. The man before, his job was to kill the pigs with a knife, essentially to cut their throats. Right? These were the jobs that people did hundreds of times a day. They were stunned, killed, drained of blood, skinned, emptied of entrails, split and turned into cuts of meat or processed for sausage and mincemeat. The plants were devised to waste nothing of the animal, to use everything but the squeal, the oft-repeated joke in Chicago went. Not only lard and tallow, but hide, hooves, hair, tendons, ligaments, bones, and blood were collected and transformed into saleable commodities. Products included leather, soap, fertilizer, glue, ivory, gelatin, shoe polish, buttons, perfume, and violin strings. So essentially the stockyards consisted of something like 200 separate jobs. The people at the top of the hierarchy were the guys with those great big knives. They were the splitters. They were the splitters. They had the highest rate of pay. They could split an entire carcass with one blow. The only guys at risk were the two men on either side who held the carcass for them The men on the lowest rank of the lowest rank were the men who simply swept the blood off the killing floor, and there was an intricate hierarchy of work between. And then here's Armour's famous, a half mile of pork, Armour's great pouring house. It's fascinating, but the disassembly line really in many ways was the inspiration for the assembly line. It started that way. They said these were called the most expert workmen in the plant, the best played. They made those difficult, precise cuts. The cleaver men, great giants with muscles of iron, and we can see them there. Well, I think I have to stop now. I could go on for a much longer time. This may be more than you want to talk about, but just to quickly mention, we go from the disassembly line to the assembly line, and the nature of work there. We go to the evolution of the office. From the merchant's clerk to the
To the publishers and accountants we see in New York City in the 1850s, to the great post office in 1850 with the constantly present overseers. I don't know if anyone was going postal then. Bartleby the scrivener of Mexico is the first example of going postal. I think we can think of that kind of employment. And here, I think it's just interesting. Next door to the mechanized violence of the cutting of the stockyards is what's famed as the most efficiently organized modern office in late 19th century America, Armour's white collar workers work in this clean, pristine, highly organized, highly bureaucratic organization where there are clear charts showing the flow of paper from one section to another. And a block away are the stockyards themselves. Talk about the appearance of women in the workforce, first as shop girls, then as typewriters and office girls. Here is Rose France, the world's champion typist. And there were typing competitions all over the United States in the 19-teens and 20s. She became Miss Remington, and her image was used to sell Remington typewriters for 15 years. She later founded her own business school. Neatness counts is what she said. That was her motto. The telephone girls, my wife's family and my own family both had several of our unmarried aunts and great aunts became telephone operators as part of this other expansion of American work. Discuss the office romance, where the office becomes the major place where men and women meet in court, but also sometimes that we have harassment as well. Yes, this is the wonderful set of stereotypes about the office. Not quite the office romance, the office romantic disaster, where the wife merges in to find the young stenographer sitting on the lap of the husband. You cad. She beats them both with an umbrella and walks off.
It's the same office.
Yeah. Right. There he is, and there she finds him. And here this young executive is saying to his secretary, I'm sorry, Miss Crawford. I'll have to let you go because I can't exactly discharge my wife. But the point is that the office becomes, in fact, the theater where young engineers, accountants, and managers meet young secretaries and stenographers, and becomes one of the major American marriage markets sometime around 1910. And after that point, peddlers, newsboys, and we end on a low note. With prostitution. You have to read the book to find out about that. Well, I hope I haven't wasted too much of your time talking about some of the complexities of work in 19th century America. It's just such a vast tapestry. There are so many hundreds of stories that it's hard to summarize. I just thought I'd share a few parts and pieces with it. I would be delighted to talk to you about any aspect of it that might possibly relate. And I thank you very much for your kind attention, and thank you for coming out to hear me.
Do you have time for a couple of questions?
Absolutely, sure.
And then Jack can sign a copy of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you want to answer?
Yeah, sure. Bridgeport was the Irish enclave in Chicago. Did you live there?
My grandparents did. By the time I was born, we had moved to a neighborhood called South Shore, which is down by the lake, because we had become Lace Curtain.
Otherwise known as AB.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, so we lived there. I grew up there. Irish Catholic, yeah.
My experience is not that much different than yours. My family, my Kern family, moved from the farm in Chicago. And you're 2 years older than me, and my grandfather, who was a mechanic, didn't want any of his children or grandchildren to work like this wanted them all to get away from that. Did most people take pride in their work, or was it something they needed to escape from? I mean, you have these generational changes.
It's a very interesting question. If you look for, it depends, to some extent it depends on the trade. For instance, when I studied shoemakers, the shoemaking trade was basically turned upside down by mechanization. And by the 1880s and 1890s, men are saying, I will never go back to this trade as long as I live. It's just, you know, it's just a complete, you know, it's complete economic and moral disaster. Printers, on the other hand, tended to adapt and tended to be prouder of their craft skills, tended to adapt to new technologies which weren't as destructive to their skills as to technology.
You had the sense that some of the professions wanted their children to follow in the line?
Or was
the idea that they would then go on to be architects?
Well, some did, but, you know, so often in these narratives I read accounts of urging their children on to something different and better. There's a wonderful blacksmith's autobiography who talks about being trained as a blacksmith in Wisconsin, going west, combining blacksmithing and farming, making a fair money, and then he said, I finally saw what was happening. Hardware manufacturing was going to put the blacksmith out of business. So I decided, I sold my farm and became a hardware merchant. And he said, and now my children are going to law school. And so we see an awful lot of people with that argument. On the other hand, there are communities where, you know, in southeastern Pennsylvania there are families that have been in the land for 250 years and still encourage their children to do that. But I think that tends to be a minority view. My own grandfather left the farm to become a mechanic in the stockyards, you know, a refrigeration mechanic, a fairly highly skilled job. And really never talked about the farm anymore. That's why my father didn't even know his father had been a farmer. Yes, ma'am. Yeah?
I have a question regarding the seamstresses.
Yes.
As I was, at some point in time, as I was reviewing history books, I ran into kind of two what I would describe as abnormalities, and I would like to ask you for your opinion. In a sense that, in terms of the big fire that happened, where they were forced to either choose between that.
Oh, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. Yes. Yeah.
Inside by the fire or all that. Well, the abnormalities that I have found, and abnormalities in a sense of within the times that there were, that it occurred, were two, and I wanted to hear your opinion. One is when I was reading the fire, the way the door were locked.
Yes.
Strategically, almost like because they could have escaped, but they were barricaded in some really odd way. So was it some sort of a pervert kind of incident that took place that kind of blocked them and kind of, because it was Friday, also they wanted to get out and the fire. The second abnormalities that I found is the reaction, because as I was reading through it, what was interesting is I got a sense, which I'm not sure if you're going to share what's your opinion, that it was almost like a theater. People were watching them falling down and they were calling like a dolls, and some of them were impaled. And I'm not sure, but I got a feeling from what I have read by the eyewitnesses that it was almost like, I don't know, Louis the 16th guillotine, where people were just showing up and watching it and how they were describing it.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. One, it seems to be pretty clear that what we had in the Triangle Shirtwaist case was, remember I was talking about the kind of work discipline that was inflicted on these young women seamstresses, say, a little earlier in New York in the Stewart's store, where the entrances were blocked to keep young women from sneaking out and enjoying a little air, passing a note to a boyfriend, doing anything that would essentially get get them away from their the major business as far as the managers were concerned, which was spending every minute working and making money for them. I think there are many examples of workplaces where the exits were locked. In this case, it was a horrible set of miscalculations. Clearly, that was not the intent of the managers, but the intent was to confine them and discipline as much as they possibly could. And this kind of casually brutal workplace discipline was really characteristic of 19th century America. That's really pretty much how things were done. As terms of the spectators, I gather that there was a fair amount of grand guignol voyeurism, going on with this horrible tragedy taking place. Clearly, some people their hearts are very hard, and other people I know were terrified. And one of the things that I didn't put in the book, but I could find I could find were the photographs of policemen and firemen dealing with the bodies of the girls after they had fallen. I could see some of those. And they at least were treating the photography may or may not, we could decide whether it was respectful or not, but the men in charge of dealing with the disaster were at least dealing with the remains respectfully. That was clear, but it was pretty hard to see. I think there was some of that. I think there was some of that for many disasters. In the building of New York's Manhattan skyscrapers over a 40-year period, hundreds and hundreds of men died in falls from 30, 40, 50 stories up. And crowds would gather. It's not just Manhattan, although Manhattan is probably the most extreme case in America of the kind of crowd-hardened sensibilities. So that's all I could really offer, but I think it's an interesting observation that you're made. Yeah.
One last question.
Okay, sure.
Well, this isn't a question. This is I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I'm just here, and I wanted to hear your lecture on this. But I know that Cleveland's heyday was 1830 to 1930, and that's when they had their height, the economic height.
That's right.
And there was someone who I heard lecture in Cleveland one time, and he said the hinge pin was they went all over the world looking for school marms. And that was really why they were successful, was that they found these wonderful school marms who taught these fathers of the city who ended up making them very successful. So we didn't hear about school marms tonight.
the book was getting too long. And the section on teachers, editor said, well... It would have been interesting. Both my sons are teachers, so I'm not out there. Did you have one question?
Okay. I saw it. Yes, thank you. Yeah. I have a sense there is an undertone of ethics of employment practices and a sense of the excessive capitalism that puts people at risk. And from my trips back here to the East, knowing about the Triangle Fire and that the exits were closed because they didn't want to go into the steel fabric, so they only had the elevator in use and so forth. Here in this area, Massachusetts, with the tanneries in which people were using chemicals,
right.
And now we have cancer, particular areas where generations later people are dying. Where we come from in the West, the Gasunder program, where the short hoe was in use for quite a while, even though we knew it was maiming people, but the farmers didn't want the workers to harm the plants, so the people would suffer. And so I'm curious if you address that head on, because I pick up an undertone from you.
Well, I don't address it. From the viewpoint of a straight labor historian, from the viewpoint of or a specific advocacy, I think what I say is this: this 100-year history of work and work experience is very often a history of pain and struggle and needless death and. Simply because the ambitious extraction of natural resources, the drive to produce, to produce, to mechanize, to mechanize, to make a profit, to all that, to, you know, to is an immensely costly, risky process. Now, on the other hand, you know, I mean, the other hand, this very long, very painful process ultimately, you know, created a far more, you know, a much higher per capita income, much higher standard of living for all of us over a long period of time. I guess what this book, in one way, I'm counting the cost in this book in some ways. In some ways, no, I don't try to simply to go for the worst stories. You know, I mean, people dealt with change in a variety of ways. For some people, for some of the workers in my story, you know, life was reasonably successful. They were fortunate. They had skills. They were in the right trade. For others, you know, for shoemakers, right? Life was for shoemakers and Lynn, life was pretty much a disaster. Once the new machinery came in, because of a particular way it impacted on their skills, de-skilled them almost entirely in a period of 30 years. I mean, that's a terrible process to live through. Economic historians talk about creative destruction. Well, true, it is creative in some ways. It's also destruction. So the moral message of mine is perhaps implicit in the sense of what these stories tell us about the cost of becoming a great industrial economy.
Yeah, I think the rope
had a few comments
about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, right. Well, making pencils just didn't do it for him, as we know. So.
I have a simple question. I have a picture of School Street in Boston, 1850. And on the third floor of an office, there's a sign that sticks out over the street. And it says, females as accountants. And it actually has the graphic of a woman standing at a stand-up desk doing bookkeeping work. And I was just shocked. You know, I just assumed that in the 1850s, to the extent women worked at all, it might have been as a servant or whatever. And I was just curious if you had run across other occasions.
There are a few occasions of that. It's generally quite rare, though. I mean, it's not until period between 1880 and 1900 that women come into the office workforce in any sizable number. It really takes, for the most part, it really takes a long time. That'd be fascinating to know more about that and how well that worked.
Yeah.
Actually, as we think about it, but it's what I would say is a fascinating rarity. Very interesting. Yeah.